Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redmond.
And we are here for three more episodes, one of which, it's kind of funny, we're going to talk about right at the end of this episode. But it is an episode that I disliked when I first watched it, but I'm weird to see a incredibly relevant episode of television from 8 years ago.
In other words, we should warn people.
It's going to get political at the end of this week.
At the end of this. You can't help it with the last episode.
You literally can't. There's no way to avoid getting political with the last episode this week. We're sorry. If you don't like it when we get political, this is your warning. That's going to happen for episode 15.
Like, you're just sitting there.
No, it's mind-boggling.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Mind-boggling.
Okay, so, let's do this. Let's start with the two episodes we're allowed to watch without offending anybody. So let's do episode, 713. I assume Lucky is in the... No, Lucky already was in it.
Oh,
8
no.
is in the title? What's in the title?
No. Snake Eyes is in the title.
Oh, because he's unlucky. Right, okay. I get it.
I don't know why they wouldn't have called it Lucky 8. Or
well,
Unlucky
No,
eight.
They had already done an episode famously called Lucky so they didn't want to, yeah. But that was my thought as well. All right. So, yes, this is an episode about gambling, and specifically a gambler played by TV's Superman, Dean Cain.
Okay.
So hit us up with a synopsis.
When an Atlantic City, New Jersey casino floor manager is beaten to death and found with 8 $1 bills surrounding a playing card placed on his corpse, the BAU suspects the crime was committed by a ritualistic killer with a gambling addiction. Meanwhile, Garcia fears the worst after waking up from a night of heavy drinking and finding an unexpected visitor in her apartment. Now, I got to say something.
Please.
Okay. This is so hilarious because in this episode, we see Kevin is in this episode again, right?
Yeah, briefly. Yeah.
And on my, because I put my stupid, anyways, I have the stupid app now on my phone for YouTube.
Oh,
and
okay.
So on the run through, it's got a new Criminal Minds cast with their partners and some cast members. One of them, I don't even know who it is, but anyway, so they're showing it, right? And Kirsten Vangnes has, since the last one I saw,
okay,
has gotten married.
Good for her,
right? But you look at the guy, like, he didn't look as much like Kevin in the previous one, but right now I'm going, so she married a Kevin lookalike.
Really?
It's really weird. I mean, he's really, really tall. He's much taller than
Nicholas
Zander
Brandon.
Was, but yeah, Nicholas Brandon or anything. But it was really funny. And just to add, we're just before we get to this episode, which is a very difficult episode. Yes, and it turns out Matthew Gray Gubler has girlfriend after girlfriend. They last about 18 months at the most.
Oh, no.
Shamar in 2014. So that would be 5 years. So that's around when he was going to leave. I don't know if he got married or he's got a steady girlfriend. It's down there now.
Okay. That's good.
And then there was nothing else terribly surprising. We already knew Prentice had gotten married and Matthew Gray Gubler did the ceremony. So
yes, that one I remembered.
Yes. So anyway, never mind.
It's interesting to find out that it's like, oh, which raises the question. Was it her suggestion to cast Nicholas Brendan in the first place? Does she have a type? Because if you think about it, when was Lucky? Season 3? Midway through season 3?
Something like that.
Yeah, like 3:15, 16, somewhere around there, I think. And so it really raises the question of, like, did she, like, when they were saying, we want to write you a love interest, did she say, oh, can we get Nicholas Brendan from Buffy the Vampire Slayer? Because that's exactly her type. Because I feel like it's not a big part. So it's a kind of situation where an actor could say, oh, well, can you try to get this actor? And they just do it.
Yeah, because it's not a consistent, continuous part.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, it's not the kind of part where you're going to be putting in the opening credits and you're going to have to give them a contract. It's just like, literally whenever we need you, we'll give you a call, is the kind of part, Kevin Lynch is. And it's weird. I watched this episode. I'm like, I really do feel like she was at fault again. Like, because you hear they had a big fight and he stormed out. And I'm like, I just can't imagine, given how understanding this man is.
Yeah.
For all of her stuff. I can't imagine she wasn't at fault in whatever their fight was.
Well, yeah, he just seems to...
he's so supportive.
He's so supportive of her and with the work he does. Because he does the same kind of weird work, yeah. Right? I mean, he works with the CIA, I guess.
Yeah,
with the FBI?
He might be still with the FBI because she, you know, screwed up his career.
Oh, yeah.
By not letting him get that State Department job. So
that's right, yeah. So
he might still be with the FBI. It is weird that we never see him, even though he theoretically works inside the building.
Yeah, you know, but every now and then he shows up. They've got a few minutes to fill.
Yeah.
In an episode they've got a few minutes to fill, so they stick in Kevin Lynch.
Yeah.
Anyway, I guess we can talk about that. I mean,
talk about that more later, but because he will leave, I think next at the end of the season is, I think, when they break up for good. But I'm not sure.
Well, do we have the?
It's just we find out that they're donezo for good in the same episode. We find out that Joe has been dating Aaron Strauss. So it's really a question of when exactly that happens, and I can't tell you. So let's move on to the actual episode, which is, like, it's one of those episodes. I often talk about this on the show, and I mean, you've noticed this in my reviews. I'm sure I've talked about it here, which is, there are so many episodes where, like, the crime just couldn't have gotten away with it because... Like, they're like, oh my god, there's no record of the murder because the mob guy who was running the casino kept a private security system in his thing, so only he had footage of who he was dealing with in his office, and the tape has been stolen. I'm like, yeah, but the casino has footage of him and Dean Cain walking into his office.
Yeah,
and then the casino... And then the casino has footage of him and Dean, of only Dean Cain leaving right after the murder, so...
With blood on his hands.
With blood all over him, carrying a bunch of cash. I kind of feel like this wouldn't be a hard crime to solve.
Well, yeah. I think most of the crimes this week could have been easy to solve, but...
Yeah,
you'd think. Yeah, but this one is... This one, like, I'm going... Yeah, well, but there are cameras in the hall, aren't there? And
there's,
I mean,
cameras
he
in the
kind
whole
of
casino.
Just because nobody's, you know, like, and why he didn't leave the casino? Well, of course we know why, because
he's an addict. Yeah,
he's an addict, and so he's not going to leave that casino because why?
Well, no, he goes and he gambles after he wins. He walks out. He kills the guy. He plays the slots in the same casino where he killed the guy. And he plans to leave, but then he wins $250 or $500 or whatever. Yeah. And so but then he takes that money and he leaves. And then the rest of his gambling is in another casino. Another casino, right? And this is, like, again, how has this guy not been caught immediately? Guess what? You know what, do you know what have security cameras in them? Atlantic City Casino parking lots? Yeah. They have lots of security cameras in them and security in them. Because guess what? The casino understands that people are going to be walking out of the casino and going to their cars with money.
Yeah.
So they have security cameras there.
Yeah.
Also, it kind of makes me nostalgic for the TV show Las Vegas that was about how tightly controlled security was in those places. Yeah. Because you think about it, like, so this woman gets murdered after spending all night with Dean Cain, and then Dean Cain's wife, right? And then no one checks the video of what she was up to in the casino. Oh, she spent all night with this guy, and then, you know, he follows her out of the casino at the end of the night, and she winds up dead? Maybe look into that.
Yeah, I mean, his best friend makes the connection.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And he doesn't even have camera work. Like, he doesn't even have video of her spending all night on his arm.
Yeah.
Like, they want to do an episode about a murder around a casino, and they can't get over the giant problem with that, which is casinos are 100% surveilled. You can't kill someone inside a casino and get away with it. It can't happen. People do murder people in casinos, but they get caught right away.
Even if you killed somebody in the bathroom, they've got the cameras that are showing right who goes in and out.
Exactly.
You know, who goes in and out? Who goes in and out? Who goes in and out? Like a city like Las Vegas and a city like
Atlantic City
are just full of surveillance cameras.
Absolutely. They are the pre-Londons, you know, like you can't get away with anything there.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, they're looking for people who are cheating and everything else, but.
Oh, yeah.
It
doesn't matter whether or not they're investigating people who are cheating. They have the video footage of everything, whatever they want to use it for. The video footage is there and they can search for these people. And this episode never gets over the idea of. And the thing is, it's not even that hard to fix. Just, like, have them know what the guy looks like. What's the problem with that?
Mm-hmm.
That if he's not, you know, like, maybe they don't get a good enough angle on his face that they're able to... Here's my fix. They don't get a good enough angle on his face that they're able to get a... that they're able to run it against the DMV. Yeah. But they know what he looks like, and so they're looking for him. You know?
Yeah. And he never changed his clothes.
Yeah.
If
they have any camera footage, he would have been so easy to find.
Well, you know, they could have him change his clothes. And then, you know, that would make it a little more difficult to find him.
Yeah, that kind of worked.
Like little, you know, the conclusion, sometimes I sit here and go, do none of these people actually really watch TV? Like, you know, they work in TV, write TV, but do they actually watch TV?
I profoundly doubt that they do.
And how many of them go, like they go off to film schools and whatever. And the thing is that when they do that, right, of course they get a lot of theory.
Of course.
A lot of friggin' theory. They get taught how to... I mean, not that there's anything wrong. Me, I live for theory, right?
You're an academic. You're not downplaying theory, but...
But what I'm saying is they get theory. They learn how to do camera angles. They learn how to do this. They learn how to run machines. They learn how to sit down and edit their own films and stuff. And hence we get so many crappy shorts. They learn how to do all of this, but they don't actually sit down and watch. Like, it doesn't do you any good to watch the masters doing their films, right? Like watching, you know, some of the greats. And they don't even watch. As I said, I already knew somebody who taught film. And she had never seen a Rainer Werner Fassbinder. She had never seen a Wim Wenders. She had never seen any of the German.
Yeah, like the new German 1960s and 70s into 80s existentialist filmmakers.
It stunned me, you know. Yeah. But the thing is that I can sit there and talk about those things politically, and I will show them if I'm teaching German history. You know, that's a show them one of them, although they don't like to read subtitles, etc. There's all sorts of great things, but you know, but you have to watch it and enjoy it.
Yeah.
Like, you have to watch TV. If you're writing for TV, you have to watch.
You have to see the value in it, and you have to watch it. Yeah.
And you have to watch it. You have to enjoy it, which is what we do. I mean,
that's true.
Ultimately, we enjoy this. I am not ever going to. There's all sorts of stupid things on TV. And the rest of it. But it is the new books.
Of course.
Right? Like, how can you write a book if you've never read a book?
Yeah. And honestly, you're right that it feels when you're watching a lot of these shows, it feels like these are people who don't care about the form at all.
Well, they might have got, or telling stories, like telling stories that work. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to look at the greats of television to see how you tell a story that works. Absolutely. From beginning to end within, you know, and you have to, I guess you have to get your chops on the floor, basically.
Yeah. I think that's true.
Anyway, I don't know why it's this episode that made me think about that, because, you know, and when you're talking about Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Well, what? Sure, there's Las Vegas. Why have you not watched our favorite Runaways? Crime Story.
Exactly. Yeah. All of these shows about Vegas and how it works and all of that. And you get this one about Atlantic City and you're like, they just don't understand it fundamentally.
If you don't understand how the business that you're setting your murder in works, then you can't set a good story.
Yeah.
Now, they did.
Spoiler alert, this won't be the last time that happens.
Yeah. It's a norm, which is why I'm going, do any of these people watch television?
No, I'm
in
right
their
there
spare
with you.
Time. No. Now, okay. Now,
I can confirm one thing. I can confirm that at least one person at Criminal Minds watches the show Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. Because in season 14, I just reviewed an episode that was 100% based on a segment from Last Week Tonight.
Yeah, okay, we'll get there.
So I can confirm that.
Yeah. And, you know, well, some of them. Never mind. I'm just being... What I'm going to say...
It is weird, you're right, that this is the episode that triggered that in you. You're totally... It is strange.
It's strange because... Anyway, but what the one thing they do get, like, I fully believe this gambling addiction, this guy.
Yes, totally.
And what's happening to him, you know?
Oh, yeah. And again, especially because they actually go out of their way to talk about the fact that, you know, gamblers are all magical thinkers.
Yeah.
They will look for anything. You always hear, I mean, sports people are the same way. You always hear stories about people never changing their socks during season and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. Like all of this stuff that the magical thinking that goes into when you believe profoundly in luck, this is what it turns you into. And this is just the logical extension, like the most ridiculous extrapolation of that.
Yeah. Well, and it would like, here, I'll tell you about magical thinking. So I'm trying to explain to my ESL class on Monday, because I made this comment.
Yeah.
Okay, that like it was threatening rain.
Right.
So when I went to class, because I take the bus and I walk, I took my raincoat, even though it was hot. I took my raincoat, shoved it in.
Whatever. Just in case.
Right. And so we were talking about this and looking outside. And I said, at one point, I said, yes, I said, I brought my raincoat so it won't start raining until after I get home. Because my raincoat is, anyway.
I know.
So anyway, and then I said, that's an example of magical thinking.
Yeah.
That I can have an impact.
It's not
hard.
It's an easy concept.
Understand that no, I think that I can affect the weather. And this guy thinks that if he can kill people, he can turn his luck around.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Yeah.
It worked. And the problem was it didn't work the one time. And it was because he killed a stranger. And then he kills the guy who's closest to him. And then he's going to go kill his wife.
Well, and the interesting thing is, he kills the guy who is closest to him, and it still doesn't go well for him, because he doesn't get very far in the poker tournament, because he's caught.
Yeah, well, yeah, he's caught, but
the funny part about it, by the way,
in his head, he would have known he would have won that game if he hadn't gotten caught.
You're right, in his head, he does, he definitely believes that, you're totally right. Yeah. The funny thing about the poker scene, though, is that it's like, does this guy seriously get away? A, because Reed tries to reach out and grab his keychain? Like, are you the worst at being undercover, Reed? And then he also gets away because they didn't bother surrounding the building. Like,
well, why would we bother calling the local cops to surround the building?
I know. Well, you know
we
what?
Don't talk to
they
the
don't even
cops.
Need the local cops. There's friggin' six of these people. They could have surrounded the building themselves.
Well, and the casino is full of security.
Well, it's not a casino. It's a private club. But yes, well, it is also club. Full of security. Yes.
It's, excuse me, yes, it's a private club. He goes to the private club and it's full of security.
Oh, yeah, there's no way this guy gets away. Like, but and it's so crazy watching that scene because you're like, did he seriously just get away? Because they, because Reed blew his cover by being terrible at undercover work. And then B, even worse, they didn't bother to have the place surrounded. Like, they know he's going to be in this place, so it's like they take no precautions to catch him. And it's like they didn't even tell the, I mean, they didn't tell the security, by the way, we're the FBI. We're here looking for a serial killer who we think is going to be playing in your tournament. Just a heads up, he might not show up, but
yeah.
You know, when we notice him, we're going to point him out and stay out of our way. Like, that's
yeah.
all they would have had to do, and there's no problem this week.
Yeah.
His wife doesn't get traumatized, his sister-in-law doesn't get traumatized, like, all of that happens because they can't be bothered to do their job to a base level of competence.
Yeah, and you can, again, you can write it so they look competent.
Oh, yeah.
We have literally rewritten this episode, and again, you look at these episodes and you go, sometimes they're such little fixes that need to be done.
Absolutely.
Given, yeah. if you understand the where, if you understand your setting, the yeah. context, the context, shall we say, of this crime, the context, the setting, everything around it, it's an easy enough fix and you don't have to go. Now, they still would have gone to the wife. They would, but they would have had to work harder
yeah,
for him to get away.
They would have had to work harder. But honestly, all you had to do to have him get away is have him spot Reed, because like Joe says, Reed isn't good at bluffing.
Yeah.
All you have to do is have the killer make Reed as not a poker player.
Yeah.
Right? And as someone who's not very good at bluffing and not a great performer, and realize the cops are there for him and sneak out, like make like he's going to the bathroom and then, you know, grab someone else's jacket and sneak out.
Yeah.
That's literally all you have to do to have this guy get away. But no, they have to have Reed make an idiot out of himself by grabbing for the guy's keychain.
Yeah, well, the guy could have kept his keychain in his pocket, too.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, like, there's a whole stack of different things that you can do that are not major.
Yeah.
But somebody has to notice there's a problem. And
yeah,
nobody seems to ever
it.
Notice there's a problem.
I think that's true. Okay, and just a little correction from something that Joe and Reed talk about. Joe says he should compete because, oh, by the way, Joe, not wanting to risk $50,000 of his own money. Just a little note for what kind of a person Joe is.
Yeah.
Not willing to risk his own money to catch a serial killer. He's guilted into it, but he has to be guilted into it.
I know.
It's just a little note about who Joe is as a person, about who David Rossi is
Rossi,
as
is
a person.
Not Joe. Not
I know,
Joe.
It's terrible. Joe Montaigne is fine.
Joe's been married to the same woman for like 47 years.
Oh, yeah, I'm not complaining about Joe Montaigne. He gives his daughter work on a TV show. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
But the point is with David Rossi, like, it's just a little note about what kind of person he is, that he's like, no, I'm really reticent about spending my own money on this thing. But they have this little debate about how he says, you're not a poker player, Reed. And it's like, well, actually, there's an algorithm that can teach you how to bet and probability and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, here's the thing, though. That's true, right? It is true that there are mathematical rules to winning at poker. But the problem is, in high-level poker, every single person playing the game knows all of the mathematical rules about how to win at poker.
Yeah.
And fundamentally, that's why poker is 100% a game of psychology and who is better at reading other people.
Yeah, it goes down to bluffing.
Yeah, it's all about can you bluff?
In the end, when you
and the thing is, And people always say, people misunderstand bluffing. Bluffing is not just about pretending. It's often used as a description for pretending you have good cards. But that's not what bluffing is. Bluffing is your ability to make your opponents think what you want them to think.
And like, because you can have a really good hand,
but
and
if you
not
can't
want
trick
to...
people. Exactly. Yeah. If you can have the best hand in the game, but if you can't trick people into staying in that game, you're not going to make any money.
Yeah, you're not going to make any money. You don't want anybody to know you've got a good hand, so you've also got to be able to be able to not signal.
Exactly. You have to be able to not signal a good hand. You have to be able to signal that make people think you're bluffing when you actually do have a good hand. Like, it's an incredibly complicated game, and it is all psychology. And it is all practice of playing poker. And that is why you really should have sent David Rossi in, because he has years of experience of playing poker, where all that Reed has ever done is made a bunch of money playing blackjack, because blackjack is just math. There is no other component to blackjack other than math.
Yeah.
And if you can count cards, you can win at blackjack. It's as simple as that. All you have to do is be able to keep track of how many cards are dealt. If you want to, right? If you want to know, like, here's the secret. You can go read a book about this, but this is the secret. And it honestly doesn't matter how many decks they're dealing with, because when it comes down to, so you start at zero when they change the decks. And every time a face card, so that's a 10 or a face card, gets played, subtract minus one. Just say minus one. And every time anything but that is played, say plus one. And if that number, so like bet $5, $5, $5. If that number ever gets to plus 15, that means a ton of non-face cards have been played and face cards are due. And that's when you start doubling or tripling your bets. That's all card counting is. That is 100% the entirety of card counting. And it is just about your ability to keep track of all of the cards in play. And that's not easy to do, but it can be done. And I want to remind everybody, it's not illegal to do that. It is the correct way to play the game, but they will throw you out of casino if they catch you doing it.
Yeah, well, and it's what they really want to do is throw you out because you won too much.
No, that's exactly why. Like, that's exactly like, there's no subtlety. Yeah. There's no, you're right, there's no.
Yeah.
It's not about the purity of the game. They just don't want to lose money.
Yeah, and the thing is, but the funny thing is that most people will eventually get tired and start counting wrong, even the people that count. Because it's, you know, I mean, you get tired.
It's exhausting, focused work.
Yeah, because it is massively focused work. And so you get tired and you slip up. And then this is why if you're winning at blackjack, the minute you start to lose, you just go, like, you lose more than one card hand, you go, okay, I'm too tired. I think I better take a break and leave now.
Yeah. And that's
with
that's
whatever
the
I've got.
And the difference, the reason, what makes you an inveterate gambler is your ability to, your complete inability to cut your losses.
Yeah. Just to cut your losses. Okay. I'm ahead. I'm ahead $500. Okay, I've now lost 150 of that 500.
A sane person will say, I can walk away with $350.
Yeah, and come back.
An inveterate gambler will say, my luck will turn.
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what Dean Cain is playing in the episode. Like, just this guy who doesn't know when to walk away. Because at one point in these episodes, he's got, like, you know, $30,000 to his name. But he wants to get into a poker tournament that costs $50,000, so he can't walk away. Because there's always a bigger score. And as his wife accurately says, you know, no matter where you go, there's always going to be an excuse to gamble.
Yeah.
And I've never... Like, here's the thing. And this is going to be a weird thing to go to. Do you remember that show Luck that was on briefly, but it got canceled because they kept killing horses?
It vaguely sounds. I'm trying to think.
It was created by the same guy who wrote all of NYPD Blue and created Deadwood, David Milch. Right?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And Jason Gedrick was the inveterate gambler, the Dean Cain part in it. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Really good show. Very compelling. Horses kept dying because they do in horse racing. It's disgusting how many horses die every year in that horrible sport. But anyway, horses kept dying.
Chuck wagon races.
God. But yeah, and the thing that's so upsetting, right, is that, like, it's weird how I had no idea how many horses die every year horse racing. And then this show, two horses died producing the show, and everyone's outraged. And the producers were like, you know, a bunch of horses die every week horse racing, right? Like, this isn't unusual. But because it was a TV show, people pay attention to it who aren't, you know, inveterate gamblers. Yeah. But anyway, the fascinating thing about the show is Jason Gedrick plays a character who in the first episode, because he is a good handicapper, wins himself something, you know, I don't remember the amount, but you know, $800,000, some crazy amount. And the entire first season is about how he can't stop throwing that money away.
Yeah.
And it's about, and it's like, and he's so frustrating to watch because you're like, why can't you just stop? And the thing is, and this is how bad this gambling addiction is. I find out that they could never, like, that David Milch had no insight into why he couldn't stop or what caused this is because David Milch is an inveterate gambler.
Ah.
That he was writing the show about his own experiences. Every dime he made from writing all of NYPD Blue and creating Deadwood, you know, well, co-created, but anyway, all of that went away on poker and horse racing. All of it.
You're kidding.
Every dime.
Oh,
and we're talking tens of millions of dollars here.
Yeah.
And that is the fascinating thing. That's how bad this gambling addiction is. The man gambled away every money from one of the most successful TV writing and producing series of the past, careers of the past 20 years. All of it went to the track. And that's why the show's so frustrating. And so it's like, yeah, I'm not saying I have sympathy for Dean Cain's character in this episode. Because he is, you know, I mean, he does murder people. But it's like, that's how powerful this gambling addiction is.
Yeah.
Like, it completely destroys the lives of even super rich people. So, it may be a sloppy episode from a plot standpoint, but I think...
It does psychologically, very well. Yeah.
It's 100% true to how these guys are.
Yeah, he just cannot stop. And that's all there is to it. It doesn't matter who, what, when, why, you know. Yeah. And his wife finally comes to understand that, you know, people who gamble have to get caught. Yeah. And it's horrible because
she has to draw the line somewhere.
There are numerous cases in the Sioux. First, when they opened the casinos across the river, like there was some guy who was a really big, he was a news anchor. He was lost everything.
Yeah.
Lost everything. It doesn't matter what his name is. And then there was somebody at the university
who just lost.
And
everything.
She got walked out of the university. Just like that, there was this, she's gone, you know, like notification, she's gone, she got walked out.
Oof.
And we found out later, like everybody knows because it's not a secret because guess what? You know,
it's just a small town.
And the news, it's in the news, but because it's a small town, I mean, it was a sad story. Because she was under house arrest. She was not allowed to use computers and the whole thing for.
So she was embezzling money, or?
Oh, from the university, yeah.
You left that part out of the story.
Oh, she embezzled thousands of dollars from the university.
Yeah, you left that part out of the story the key. And that was kind of central to the story. You kind of skipped that part. But anyway, no.
It's because of gambling. Like, and you just sit there. No. I mean, the things that ended up happening because of the gambling. I'll tell you about afterwards.
We can talk about that another time. We're not here to dunk on this lady. But
well, no, she was a friend of mine. She was,
I understand that. That's one of the reasons we're not here to dunk on this lady. No, but it's a tragic situation. And this, I mean, for anything we're going to say about this episode, it is brutal to Dean Cain's character. But I think what it says about the type of person he is, I think it's fundamentally true. Like, it really is an episode that says something real about people with this condition.
With gambling addictions, and then you just take it to this end level.
To this extreme level,
Well, yeah, because it's a... And I have no problem. I have no problem with the plot, as I said.
No, we have, we have no problem with the take on his character. Yes. The investigational, that's garbage. The psychology is dead on. And that's the thing. The psychology is dead on. All right.
So whoever did that part did a really good job. I said whoever
They really did. Yeah. Like, they really did. I would totally agree with that. So let's move on to the next episode, which is
Closing Time. And as I said, they didn't.
Yeah, I know. Next, go for it.
Okay, when three men are gunned down and castrated post-mortem while visiting Los Angeles, California on business, the BAU determines the victims and the killer are connected by a personal loss. Meanwhile, Hotch prepares to go on his first date since Haley's death.
Yep. Well, it has been 2 years, and they're split up for a year before then, so I guess it's time.
Yeah. I don't have any problem.
No, it's fine.
Hotch date.
No, it's fine if Hotch wants to go out on a date. We won't see much of her after this episode, like once or twice, but that's pretty much it. They never do a lot with his relationship, and they break up off camera at some point. So yeah, it's too bad that this never went anywhere. You know, the way they do a full relationship arc with Derek and then Luke. But yeah, it's sad that that Hotch didn't get one of those, but honestly, it's not that big. It's not like a deal breaker or anything terrible.
Well, besides, you know,
Absolutely. So it's interesting to me, right, as I'm watching the episode, is it's funny because I was just the last week or the week before talking about that looping. And this is the episode I was thinking of. Because there's this great scene where it's like, so he has murdered this woman. Like, he has stabbed this woman to death and cut her to pieces and thrown her in a dumpster. Right? Yeah. And we see that the team is coming to the dumpster. And then at some point after making the show, someone said, watching the edit, wait a minute, this is a guy who shoots men in the head and then cuts off their genitals and then leaves them in lifeguard stations. Why on earth is the team showing up at the crime scene of a woman who was stabbed to death and thrown in a dumpster? And of course, there's no reason for them to be there. So they loop in a line of dialogue, which is like, the Emmy has matched the cuts to the the cuts to the knife that was used in the other crimes. Yup. the body's still in the dumpster. Forensic has not matched anything. No, you forgot. And this is the thing. No, the writer forgot that the characters didn't know this was one of the victims. And that's the thing. The writer knows that this is one of his victims, but he forgot that the characters don't know that when he or she was writing the episode. And that happens all the time in writing. They forget which characters have which information. And that is something that happens all the time in bad writing.
This is Rick Dunkel.
Oh, it's Rick Dunkel. Okay. So yeah, it's just something he forgot when he was writing the script. And this happens plenty of times in Criminal Minds. It's just weird that they noticed this time and tried to fix it so awkwardly.
Yeah, well, you know, they do try every night. Well, it just shows you somebody in the editing room, as you say.
Yeah. There is a hero in the editing room who noticed this problem. And it's just like, quick, okay, I got this shot where you can't see David's mouth. Get Joe Montaigne in here to record a line to fix this. Yeah, there'll be another one when there's going to be another one coming up soon with William Russ that is a similarly bad plot thing. But we'll talk about that when William Russ is on. William Russ, one of our favorite actors, for reasons we're going to talk about in that episode.
Yes. Sometimes I think we just watch this so we can talk about other shows.
Well, it's going to come up. We're TV people. It's going to come up.
Yeah. As we noted at the beginning.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
No, it's funny. It's just, as an episode, it's serviceable, I guess.
Yeah, it's serviceable. Like, yeah. You actually feel sorry for this poor guy.
Oh, yeah.
Unbelievable what happened to him.
Yeah.
You know, like when you first watch it, you know, when you're first beginning, okay, so his best friend is sleeping with his wife. And then it turns out his best friend has been sleeping with his wife for the whole marriage.
Yeah.
It would appear.
Oh, no, definitely. That's confirmed. Yeah.
Yeah. And none of them. You know, and what's the best friend going to say? First of all, the best friend should have changed the locks, had security changed.
Oh, God, I know.
But, of course, he's got all this guilt, so he doesn't.
Yeah. God, yeah.
But at the same time, you're just sitting there, this poor guy. I have to admit, I did understand why he went just a little bit nuts.
Oh, absolutely. Finding out when his son is 17.
Yeah.
That it's secretly been another guy's son, his best friend's son, this whole time. Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean.
It's rough.
And the funny thing is it's not unbelievable that things like this happen, right?
No, they do. Absolutely.
And, you know, but you're just sort of sitting there, this poor guy. And I don't know how, I'm sitting there going, well, he could have, could he, I don't know how he could have handled this.
No, it's one of those things where the situation is so awful. You're like, I don't know what this guy was supposed to do.
Yeah. And that's the function of the show. I mean, that's what the show is basically about. This guy doesn't know what the freak to do.
Yeah.
He just doesn't know. His whole world is gone and he doesn't know what to do.
Every single part of his life has suddenly just been torn apart.
Yeah.
And he has nothing.
Yeah, nothing.
Yeah.
Not even his son.
Nope.
You know, I mean,
Holy
shit.
It's a rough one. It is a rough hour.
Yeah.
Yeah,
a little crazy too, if I found that.
In that kind of situation, totally. We get how this happened. And again, we're not giving the guy a pass for serial killing.
No, of course.
But it's one of the few episodes where it's like, you 100% get exactly why this happened.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, actually, and now that goes to the last episode as well. You don't approve of what he did. It's stupid magical thinking.
Of course.
But it rings true.
Yeah. No, this is two episodes in a row that are just very psychologically well observed.
Yeah.
Because, and the thing is, I mean, I can make the joke I always do, which is that, okay, well, for all of their love of trying to figure out psychology, they didn't catch the guy until he killed his best friend. And then the best friend goes to the guy's ex-wife and it's like, well, who might have murdered your lover? Well, I did just leave my husband for this guy and also tell my husband that he's the father of my child.
Which means they've been having an affair for years.
You know, 20 years. He's the only possible suspect.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's so funny because it's like this microcosm of everything I say about how profiling can't help. It doesn't matter that they 100% figured out what the guy's motive was. Until he killed someone he knew, there was no way to catch him. And the moment he killed someone he knew, it doesn't matter if you figured out the psychology of why he did it. And that's the thing that's so crazy.
Yep.
Like, and that's why profiling at its core is, you know, of so little value, is that it can't help you find the guy. And after you found the guy, it doesn't matter why he did it.
Yeah.
Like, here's what profiling has taught us. If we could have robots raise our children and not abuse them, there would be no serial killers. Mm-hmm. Oh, and if, you know, if kids also never got frontal lobe brain damage.
Well, yes. But then again, I mean, it was fascinating. Have you ever read the Philip K. Dick little short story about the robots, the child that's raised by robots? Yeah.
Who, of course, turns into a psychopath.
Yeah, he turns into,
All the new generation of kids raised by robots are all psychopaths because they haven't been raised around people. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, maybe the robots could look like people and be warm and caring, and the kid didn't know they were robots. All right, I'm stretching this too far. Having robots raise your children, I might have gone a little too far with this theory.
I think, you know, this is why we like people like Philip K. Dick, you know, he does remind us.
He points this stuff out. There are downsides.
There are downsides to this.
To these fantasies we come up with. Yeah. No, but that's the thing. What it comes down to is it's like, yeah, it's very emotionally true, this episode. Although it's weird. Again, we get that moment where they're like, you can't kill him or you'll go to jail. I'm like, well, you gave that lady a pass a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Remember?
Uh-huh.
It's like, how do you people decide when you're going to give someone a pass for murdering somebody?
They have to be your friend. We figured that out already.
I know.
If it's your friend, then they get a pass.
Kill whoever you want. I wish that weren't the case. But that is really the morality of this show. That they will abuse power, but only to help their friends. They are happy to abuse power, but only to help their friends. They're very strict about that. They will not abuse their power to help strangers. Now, that's not the same as having a moral code. No. But at least they have some structure to their system.
Yeah. Well, we're beginning to see that now.
Oh yeah, it's gradually turned up. Yeah, I don't remember. I know I saw another like crazy abuse of power recently in one of the episodes, and I'm like, yeah, you guys will just casually abuse power, won't you? Really will, as long as it's for your benefit, though. You know, hey, you know what? I hate to say it, but as long as you're not making money out of it, I guess that's okay. Yeah, go ahead. Seriously, though. No, but I mean, the thing is, whatever I say about, while I can use this episode as a perfect point for why profiling is kind of useless, just as an hour of television, I think it's a solid hour. I think it really does a good job. Like, you feel for this killer in a way that we don't often feel for killers.
No.
You know? And that's the thing. And you come away with it feeling rotten about the world. And we may not like that we walk away from the episode feeling rotten about the world, but you got to give them the credit. They were trying to accomplish something, and they did accomplish it. So thumbs up to this episode, I guess. What was this episode called? I always forget.
Closing Time.
Oh, right. Thank you. You said it at the start, but I
from
just...
From the bar, you know.
No, yeah, because he's a bar. Because he's a bartender. Yeah. All right, so let's move on to the big one. And again, if you don't like political talk here on the show, this is your chance to duck out. Oh, boy.
Oh, my God. Talk about an episode that takes a real slam at the capitalist system. The
Not just the capitalist system, but whoo.
Yeah, anyway, never mind. The BAU returns to California after two Senate. Never mind. Oh, yes, they were just in Los Angeles.
No, they were literally in they were in California.
And then they had to go back home, and then they had to return right away. Yes,
yeah, okay. They get right back. Yeah. That's the crazy thing about the thing. It's like they're in Los Angeles in the previous episode, and then very next week they're back in
San Bernardino.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. The BAU returns to California after two San Bernardino families are gunned down in apparent gang-related home invasions. Meanwhile, Prentice and Morgan butt heads following a disastrous FBI inductee training session.
Yeah.
And that was a really good section.
It was. Yeah.
Well, they never butt heads, but it was a really good, like, butt heads in the...
Yeah.
In a major way, but...
Oh, totally.
They did. But anyway, yes. I mean, you can get that out of the way. She had a good comeback at Morgan. And
oh, absolutely.
That was beautiful.
Yeah. No, it is very good. I did enjoy that a lot. But yeah. I would not say that it was a, like I said, I would not say it was a major thing, but it is definitely interesting.
Yeah.
And so it gets me, right, mm-hmm. as I'm watching this episode is... has there been an episode of this show that is more relevant to our politics at the moment?
No.
It's crazy. Okay, so first off, this is going to be my little, this is going to seem weird that I have to do this, but I just want to, I don't know if anyone listening to this is ever going to be the victim of a home invasion, but here's a little tip for how to deal with a home invasion. First off, there's no reason to ever have a gun in your house. Just don't have a gun in your house. It's a bad idea to have a gun in your house. You're probably, if you have a gun in your house, you're probably statistically going to kill yourself or your child will. So just don't have a gun in your house. I know you don't feel safe in the prospect of a home invasion, but here's the thing. All of your bedrooms have furniture in them. So just get everybody in a bedroom, just pile up that furniture next to the door and call the police. And you know what? You'll be fine. Because I watched this episode and it's like, this guy, like, he's got a cell phone. He's got his daughter. And he's like, I'm going to get my gun and go looking for the killer. No, that's going to get you killed. Take your daughter's bed, push it in front of the door. You're fine. There is literally nothing he can do.
No.
He can try to push the door open. Yeah,
take your daughter, go back to your wife and your other daughter, lock yourself in a room.
Yeah, and then push the bed in front. Locks aren't enough. Push the bed in front of the door.
Yeah.
Physics means that the guy on the other side of that door will never be able to get through that door. He would have to spend an hour smashing his shoulder against it. And if you're leaning on the other side, keeping the door from opening, he will physically never be able to get through that door. You're fine. Just call the police. That's what they're there. That's what they get paid for.
Yeah.
For situations exactly like this one.
Yeah.
There's just like, do not confront a home invader. If you know there's someone in your house, lock up. Okay. So I guess what I'm trying to say is toxic masculinity is the real villain this week.
Yes.
Man, the castle doctrine is the real villain this week. Yeah.
The idea that somehow or another.
But anyway, it really does make you think that when you listen to when you get the background of the thing, it's like, it's one of those episodes that makes all local cops seem kind of incompetent. Because they find the killer's trying to make it look like there have been shootouts, right?
Yeah.
But he is, you know, dosed the guys he's killing and framing full of oxycodone.
Yeah.
And it's like, as anyone can tell you, you can't stand up when you're on that much oxycodone. Like, there is no way that these supposed murderers could be out there committing these crimes simply because they are too high on oxycodone. And it's kind of frustrating that none of the characters just say that. Like, Reed does eventually, but what bothers me is it should have been obvious to the local cops as well. Like, this is not something that's hard to figure out, is what I'm saying. And it really troubled me that the characters didn't, that it's like, it took Reed saying it for anyone to notice that. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, it makes sense. I mean, there's a lot of things about this episode that you're just going, but don't the local, you know, it is a question of, but don't the local cops?
Yeah.
Like, have something to, you know, can't they see? Don't they have a decent coroner in?
They do, because it's not like
in San Bernardino,
who could just tell them flat out, yeah, with this much oxycodone in his system, this person wouldn't be able to stand up, let alone get into a gunfight with a guy in a house. There's just no way that could happen. And and you watch and you're like, oh, okay. Well, I feel like that should be, you know, that should be something that the, you know, cops might weigh, that the local cops would absolutely have the ability to weigh in on.
Now, and right away, they should have known. Maybe this is, now, I think what they're trying to do by not noting that
the cops are so racist.
Cops are so racist.
That they believe the lie right away.
Yeah, they believe the lie.
That makes sense. I mean, I can buy that. Yeah.
That's what they're trying to say.
We don't really meet any local cops in this episode.
No, we don't.
So I can't. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I can't see what their thing is like.
That seems to be, particularly when you see the interaction between that. That's when you kind of go, okay, that's what they're trying to do. When you see the interaction between JJ and the mother of the kid who's going to school.
Yeah. because she is so frustrated because the idea that everyone assumes that her son would have been a criminal just because he's black.
Black, yeah.
Yeah. And so you're right. Yeah. There is obviously a lot of racism in this town, clearly. And yeah. It is, you're right, it is the kind of thing where the cops would likely just, we'll call a spade, we'll assume that what seems to have happened, and then we'll just go home.
Yeah.
But at the same time, and I can't stress this enough, the one thing I can't forgive the show for, is they don't understand that, here's how housing developments work, okay? How housing developments work is that, you'll have a single road leading into the housing development, and then you'll have a bunch of spurs inside creating a little, creating like a ring of houses inside the housing development. That's how all housing developments work, okay? So if the cops had been called, there's no way this guy gets away. Like the guy, because he has to drive out of the housing development if he wants to get away, but he can't because there's only one road in and out of the housing development. So the cops would have immediately caught this guy as he tried to escape. And that's just a fact. That's how housing developments work. Because if you think about it, the cops, I mean, how bad, if they already know that there are killers running around, like this is the second home invasion mass killing in this town. The cops have to be on high alert after the first one. Right. And so when they get this call from the little girl, they got to be scrambling immediately. And if they're scrambling immediately, I don't understand how they don't catch this guy. And I know it's because the rest of the episode needs to happen, but it's like.
Yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth.
I mean, I know that. Intellectually, I know that. I just want to point out to everybody that that's just not how housing developments work. And anyone who's been in a suburban housing development understands that, that there is only ever one way in and out of those housing developments. That's just how they're designed. They keep people trapped. I know. I find them creepy too. There's a lot of fiction about how creepy those neighborhoods are.
I never lots of wanted
songs,
to
lots of fiction.
Oh.
So that guy would have been caught right away. So let's talk about the Donald Trump in the room. This is an episode of television about Donald Trump running for president? Like, written how many years before that happened?
Well,
it is an episode about a corrupt land developer running for mayor of a town. And the platform he's running on is that all black people and immigrants are killers, and I'm going to protect you from them.
Yep, I know.
That's insane!
That's exactly, you're just looking at this episode and going, okay, it aired in 2012, so it had to have been written in 2011.
No, I mean, it's second half of the year, so it could have been, actually, you're right, it must have been written in 2011. I'm just trying to think of exactly when it aired, but yeah, you're right, it definitely aired in 2012.
It definitely
was written in 2011. Oh, February, then of course it was. Mm. Yeah, so Donald Trump, I mean, yeah, he was doing the birth certificate racist stuff, sure, but like, he wasn't doing all of this other stuff yet. And yet this is an episode that could be written today as a crude metaphor about him. Down to the fact that we find out the backstory is that he would pay people to, like, attack families in houses to lower property values. Famously, Donald Trump, back in the 70s, would pay homeless people to move into buildings and trash the place to try and get people to leave so that he could tear down the buildings and redevelop the space.
Yep.
Like, it is. It's a more extreme version of the actual Donald Trump story. And it's so on the nose that if it had been written today about President Donald Trump,
it wouldn't be on the air.
Yeah. Like, they wouldn't. They would pull it. Like the SVU episode they pulled that was about Donald Trump raping a child. Which, by the way, still has never aired anywhere.
Yeah.
They did that episode. It's never aired anywhere. So, there you go. Yeah. You know what? He just raped a woman in the episode. It was Donald Trump raped a child in the Good Fight episode based on that real life thing that happened. My bad. But the point is, it's like you can't imagine this thing getting on television today, even though it never once mentions Donald Trump.
No.
Right? And of course, it presumably wasn't written with Donald Trump specifically in mind.
No, this because if it was, they would have made him a TV.
Yes, they would have made him a TV guy as well as a land developer.
Yeah.
That's true. But yeah, the fact is, it is literally, I mean, in the moment we're recording, I don't know what the world's going to look like when you listen to this episode, but the day we're recording this episode, we are 1 week out from Donald Trump just openly becoming a racist and telling non-white people to go back where they came from. Like, that is where we are at in the world, is the president of the United States is telling you, if you're not white, you're not American.
Yeah.
And that's what this episode is about.
Yeah.
Like, to the point where, and I may have made a joke about this at the time, they want to make it so clear that this is just about race that they have a guy called Derek Morgan half-breed.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's how racist this guy is. And I'm like, it's important to the writers to get that message in there, because when you're watching the episode, you're like, he saw Derek Morgan for 1 second in a pitch black house. And my first thought upon seeing, like, I don't believe fundamentally that he was able to figure out that Derek Morgan was biracial in that moment, but they wanted to just reinforce how much this guy is a racist.
Yeah.
So they also said, yeah, he's also, they want to get in the moment that, yeah, he's against the mixing of the races as well. They need to get that because they need to make it so clear exactly what this episode is about.
Yep.
And it is right in your face.
So, and I mean, to come for us to be doing this today, because of course, Trump, if you don't know today, has doubled down on it. Like,
yeah.
I haven't been watching too much of the news because I just can't watch this.
I know, it's too upsetting. I guess no one is going to blame you for that. Don't worry.
No. But I started watching sort of the odd thing. And of course, I always get things on the CBC.
Naturally.
You know,
the big stuff makes its way up to here in Canada, even on our state media source.
Well, it can't even call it a state.
No, of course it's not a state media source.
A state media source. Yeah, don't even say that because people might take it the wrong way.
Yeah, they might take me seriously. You're right. I want to make it clear. I was joking. The CBC is the furthest thing from state media.
My good Lord, I listened to some of the worst Canadian music this morning because the
CBC is there to make sure that there are jobs for Canadian broadcasters for people who want to be news anchors, but that's pretty much all the CBC is for.
No, it's not. It keeps the country together. I'm sorry.
No, it does. It is a national news source that is there so that people from all across the country are getting the same news in the same completely balanced way. I mean, they're too right wing for my tastes a lot of the time, but that's pretty much it.
You know, and I mean, other people can say that. Like, other people get really, really pissed off. I have a girlfriend who gets really, really pissed off because, you know, at times they're just too right wing. Well, no, they're trying to be balanced. Or when they bash Trudeau, right? And stuff. Well, yeah, I don't like it either. But I don't think it's because they're too right wing. I think it's because they're trying to be balanced and it's really hard sometimes.
Yeah. Well, no, and that's a conversation about responsibility and media coverage that we can have on another show. We're not gonna get into what it means to be a responsible journalist in an age of the return of fascism. But you know, like that's for another time. But it's hard to avoid it when that literally is what this episode is about.
It's
about a guy who is trying to say, who's trying to make it look like America, or in this case, this town, is so filthy and crime ridden that only he can fix the town.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing that, okay, yeah, go on.
Oh, no, and I was just thinking, it's like, again, it's so crazy how much from the fascist playbook all of this stuff is drawn. And it's like, we've got to empower the police. We've got to, you know, crack down. We've got to get all of this scum out of our country, you know, out of our town. And it's like, I'll get them out of here. And again, it's, he's talking about, you know, white towns for white people. And he's talking about racial purity. He's talking about keeping this part of California just for white people. And the crazy part is, it's like, we're watching a guy do it on a debate stage on television. And you're like, isn't that, and you want to say, isn't it a little extreme that he would be using not even dog whistles, but basically saying, get all this filth out of our city? And then you look at who's president now, and you're like, I guess it wasn't that far-fetched.
No, I guess it wasn't that. And I'm not a big fan, as we all know, of Virgil Williams, but he's the one that wrote this episode.
And it's true. Like, he, whatever Virgil Williams was tapping into to write this episode.
Yeah.
Whatever we've said about Virgil Williams in the past, whatever he was tapping into, whatever he understood about America's zeitgeist, he nailed it this week.
Yeah. Just
100%
nailed it. Yep.
And it is crazy how relevant this episode of television from 2012 is to America right now.
And when you watch it in 2012, you go, oh, yeah, well, that's just extreme.
Yeah.
And you watch it today and you go, okay, so ripped from the headlines, are we?
Yeah. Ripped from the headlines.
It wasn't ripped from the headlines.
Well, honestly, the one sad part of the episode, and as you watch it this week, you're like, the thing that makes me the saddest watching the episode is knowing that I don't think the property developer goes to jail. I mean, he might not win the mayoralty, but I don't think he goes to jail because a crazy man was phoning him up and talking about his plans to murder people.
Yeah, because you can't prove.
Because you can't prove he put him up to it. Because all he has to do is say.
He put him up to it, but.
We know he did it. Well, they specifically see him talking about it, right? Right? But at the same time, you're like, at the same time, all he has to do is say, he watched my stuff on television. He has to say what the anti-abortion people say whenever there's a shooting or a bombing. Oh, he just watched my speeches on television and took it too far, but his heart was in the right place. We do need to get rid of criminals. That is what this guy would do. And I don't believe he would go to jail at the end. And that's what's so upsetting about this episode, because a guy who's this exact person is now president of the United States.
Yeah.
And I don't know that this guy in this situation would win the election, but I'm pretty sure he wouldn't be in jail at the end.
Well, all I can say is that people would say, yes, but, you know, but this guy is murdering and Donald Trump never murdered anyone. And I'm going, well, you can quasi say that rape is a form of murder, and he sure as hell
beyond raped the fact that women. The beyond the fact that he's a confirmed rapist.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I'm just going to say it. The Russian government did kill a bunch of people. They didn't do it at Donald Trump's behest, but they did kill a bunch of people to try and cover up people finding out Trump's involvement in the Russia hack. So he has benefited from murder, whether or not he's ever ordered anyone killed. And I doubt, you're right, I doubt that Donald Trump has ever ordered anyone killed. That would be going way too far.
Yeah. And besides, definitely, it's not about Donald Trump.
No,
like,
it's not about
Donald Trump. It's just about sort of this horrible developing racism in the United States that Donald Trump took advantage of. Now, the fact
that his father was a member of
Ku Klux Klan. I don't think they were thinking about Donald Trump at the time.
No, of course they weren't thinking about Donald Trump, but we have to.
Yeah.
Watching this episode in this day and age. And it's interesting because it called to mind the white supremacy thing on Wise Guy. Because fundamentally, what Derek says is true. This guy doesn't care about race.
No.
He doesn't care about black and white. He's literally just, he's a grifter.
Yeah.
Right? And fundamentally, Donald Trump is a racist, right? He actually does hate people who aren't white on principle. That's just a fact. Like, and he's raised to by his father to think that they were genetically inferior. Because, again, his dad was in the Klan, and he talks about genes all the time. Like, it's creepy how much Donald Trump talks about how genetics are all that matters and how genetics are destiny. That's what racists think. But the point is, fundamentally, on a base level, as much as those are his core beliefs, he doesn't care about any of that. And if there was more money in being pro, you know,
immigration.
If there was more money being pro-immigration, he would be pro-immigration. Because when it comes right down to it, just like in that episode of Wise Guy, the guy has used to sell refrigerators. Yeah. Now he sells white pride because it's a product you can sell.
Yeah.
And that's it. And white pride and racial animus is what Donald Trump sells today to turn a profit.
Yeah.
Right? And that's all he's ever done. He has sold things to turn a profit. He's very rarely made a profit because he's terrible at business, but he is a very good con man.
Yeah.
And that's what all of these people are. Like, the people at the top of these racist organizations, whatever their beliefs are, they tend to just be con men who are in it to make money. And are in it to improve their station in life. And this guy in this episode is exactly the same kind of guy. I mean, personally, I'm sure he doesn't like black people, but he doesn't care fundamentally about anything but turning a profit.
Yeah.
And becoming mayor is his way to do that. Ugh. It's a bleak episode.
It's a terrible episode.
Ugh.
You know?
Yeah, and
oh, I mean, it wouldn't. I doubt that we would be considering it quite as bleak if Donald Trump weren't
the president. Yeah, of course,
weren't the president. And that's that. You can't avoid that, particularly since we got this horrible stuff at his last rally, and then
Oh yeah, no, he's just now he goes to rallies and he just stokes up racial hatred. That's all he does. You know, and the New York Times can't decide whether to call him a racist or not.
Yeah, well, sorry, but you know, if
that ship has so sailed. That ship is halfway to Dover, the New York Times.
Yeah. Figure it out.
Oh, it's ridiculous. All right, so let's look at what we're looking at next week, because it's gotta be happier than this week. Because we got two bleak episodes that may have been badly written in places, but were just psychologically beautifully true. And then we got the most brutal commentary on Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Before that was a thing.
3 years, 4 years.
No, in 2015 is when he came down and said he was running for down the escalator and said he was running to for president because Mexicans are rapists.
Oh, yeah.
It was 2015. Right. Like, that is the moment that American politics were destroyed.
Yeah. Okay.
When he announced he was running because Mexicans are rapists, and the next week he was polling at number one and two.
Well, you wonder if somebody didn't do this episode because, of course, he threatened before to run.
I don't know if, and that's the thing. You'd have to ask Virgil Williams.
Yeah.
If he had Trump in mind, because Trump had been a public racist for his entire career, and he had spent, before he ran, the past 6 years being a racist to he had threatened to run for president many times, and he had been a public racist for 30 years when this episode was written. So, I mean, he could have had Donald Trump in mind, because this guy is a property developer, but who knows? Like, if Virgil Williams were to tell us, yes, it was 100% about Donald Trump, I would not be surprised at all.
Yeah.
Because I was making a joke. I don't know if I said it here on the show, but I was making a joke recently because I had watched the episode about the guy who's killing the families of the people who bullied him. And he says as his justification that you know, political candidates have said that the only way to stop terrorists is to murder their families. So that's why I'm doing this. And he's obviously talking about Donald Trump, because Donald Trump's a monster, and Donald Trump said that. And it's like, and as I was watching that episode, I'm like, it's weird for the show to be so nakedly political. And then the irony is, do you know when that episode aired?
When?
Criminal Minds airs on Wednesday. That episode, the first time they like actually criticized a current serving politician, well, not serving yet, but guy running for president, it aired the day after he got elected. Isn't that bad luck for Criminal Minds? But yeah, and the thing is, I was joking about that.
Why did they get canceled, eh? Maybe that's it.
No, that's not it. It was years ago. But anyway, so I'm watching it, right? And I'm thinking how strange it is for Criminal Minds to be so nakedly political. Because apparently I had totally forgotten this episode.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But they aren't very often nakedly
political. No, they're never political. No. This show is never political.
No.
Except for, like, this episode and that one line about Donald Trump. And
but
I'm trying to think, like, are there any other?
No, but this episode would not have been nakedly political February 29th, 2000.
You're right. You're right.
It's only...
Well, but I mean, it is... I will say one thing. It is, whether or not Donald Trump becomes president... There is a history throughout America of right-wing politicians stoking racial violence to try and get elected. I mean, that is true. But you're right that this isn't nakedly political in a way that it reads today.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I mean, that's just a storyline, right?
Yeah, it's just a storyline. But it is reflecting, like, the state of American politics.
Yeah, and there have been lots of, you know, it's still, I mean, we still have to go, the classic is Wag the Dog. You still go back and look at Wag the Dog.
It's the exact same kind of thing. Well, and it's funny when you watch this, episode, but it's like, this is, in a way, the most brutal criticism of America that maybe the show's ever done, because it is about how a guy is succeeding at politics by specifically... A, making Americans hate each other, right? Yeah. And making white people and black people and Hispanic people suspicious and hate each other. But B, about doing it strategically by attacking white men who own guns.
Yeah.
Because they know that'll freak white men out.
Yep.
They'll attack white men in their houses, and we got to make sure all of the guys are gun owners.
Yeah,
because that way they'll be double freaked out. Like, this is an incredible critique of American politics and masculinity. And it's one of the most, I mean, whether or not it was about any political thing, any specific race or any specific person, it is overall one of the most political, we are saying something about America episodes of Criminal Minds that there's ever been.
Yeah, and they have every now and then said things, but it's not not their stock and trade by
it is not the waters they swim in normally.
No.
All right. So what are we gonna be doing next week?
Okay. Don't expect happiness from this
You're looking in the wrong place, baby.
Yeah. Okay.
What have we got next week?
We've got A Family Affair.
Okay.
I Love You, Tommy Brown.
Ugh. All right.
And Foundation.
Oh, okay. That should be a good week next week. So if you are watching along with us, your homework is Criminal Minds, episode 716 to 718. Family Affair, I Love You, Tommy Brown, and Foundation. Watch if you want to watch along with us. Those are what to check out. Speaking of stuff you should watch... Criminal Minds Suspect Behavior. We're coming up on the last episode of our series about that. I think that was either this week or was either this past Monday or this coming Monday. But if you haven't been listening to those, I encourage you to check them out because we really do love that show and it is instructive.
Yeah.
To look at that show. And it really is. It is instructive to say these are interesting things that Criminal Minds could have been. So be sure to check out our bonus podcasts every Monday about Criminal Minds Suspect Behavior. And of course, we're back here next Thursday for those episodes of the show. But until then, if you'd like to reach out to us with any comments, with any questions, with any suggestions, I would suggest you drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. We will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening, but until then, au revoir.
And have a good weekend.